Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
So when you think about the process of getting people up in space, obviously, first and foremost, you have to launch them, which drives you to having very powerful rocket engines that typically use fuels that can be a little bit explosive.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is Wendy Lawrence.
And I am a retired naval aviator and NASA astronaut.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM, and today we're talking about risk and rewards. How far do you push the limits of your body and machines to reach a goal? In this case, outer space. Astronaut Wendy Lawrence knows the risks of space travel very well. There's the launch day with all that explosive fuel, and returning to Earth has its own set of challenges.
Coming through the atmosphere at a high rate of speed with incredibly high temperatures, things can go wrong. And even when we're on orbit, we're exposed to risk. Flecks of paint from an old satellite or cosmic dust that's everywhere throughout our solar system. They don't weigh a lot, but they travel at a high speed, and that creates a lot of energy through a collision. So we're always concerned about something hitting us and putting a hole in the spacecraft.
On February 1st, 2003, Wendy Lawrence turned on the news, and the risk that her job involved became very personal. Seven of her friends and colleagues were gone.
My fellow Americans, at 9 o'clock this morning, Mission Control in Houston lost contact with our space shuttle Columbia. A short time later, debris was seen falling from the skies above Texas. The Columbia's lost. There are no survivors.
Did that give you pause? Did that make you hesitate?
I would say no. Because, you know, fortunately for me, at that point, I'd already had an opportunity to fly. You never get rid of your fears. It's really all about overcoming them and managing them and controlling them.
So you were assigned to the next mission?
Yes.
And what was launch day like?
Before we were actually out at the launch pad, to come out of the quarantine building and see hundreds of workers at the Kennedy Space Center there and the emotion on their face, they were cheering, they were clapping, they were crying. And at that moment, I think it really hit me that this is not about the crew. And I think all the crew, it really hit us. And it was a little bit of a quiet ride out to the launch pad, not because we were nervous, but because we were just contemplating what we had seen and processing that and realizing this is all about the crew of Columbia and about all those diligent people who had worked the 2.5 years to get us to this day. We are devoting this mission to them.
So what is the payoff? Why did you take all of these risks?
Well, obviously for me, there was a selfish award because it was my childhood dream. But I think for humans in particular, we have a desire to explore. We look up at the stars and we still wonder about them. We have this curiosity about our solar system and our universe. And so to have an opportunity to be part of the exploration of it, I think, for me certainly was very fulfilling. But I think there's huge benefits to society in general because flying in space is still not an easy thing to do. NASA brought together the best and brightest minds, and they figured out how to do that. And new technology was developed. And then you have other really smart people who are on the outside of the space program who look at that technology and say, you know, I could use that in my field.
So the reward of space exploration, the rewards are being reaped by everyone, whether they know it or not.
Whether they know it or not, virtually all of the rewards are being reaped right down here on planet Earth. Most people in the United States are not aware of this, but one of the key technologies that made the Apollo mission possible was the ability of computers to share information. Well, IBM figured out how to do that. And now virtually our entire banking system is based on the ability of computers to share information back and forth. And so we don't even really think about it anymore. But these spin-off technologies, as NASA likes to call them, are an integral part of our life now.
Wendy Lawrence, retired astronaut, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity, Jennifer.
Risk and Reward is our theme today on Sound Effect. Coming up, we'll hear from our own Kevin Kniestad weighing his options when he has a real chance to punch an insanely beloved, hated, and perhaps misunderstood pop star. A former Seahawk talks about the risks of playing football, and just ahead, we'll tell the story of a video game designer who takes the risk of shunning the traditional path. And this is a promise I know I can keep. If you spend the rest of the hour with us, the reward of great radio awaits you here on Sound Effect. Think about the risks you've taken in your life. Were they worth it? Do you regret not going for it? And what makes people take a chance? For 28-year-old Eric Baroni, it was fear.
I was afraid of the grind. I was afraid of sitting in a cubicle and just programming something that I found really boring, that I wasn't passionate about. I wanted something different. I wanted to be able to have the freedom to do whatever I wanted.
A few years ago, Eric graduated from the University of Washington in Tacoma with a computer science degree, and he had the skill and the piece of paper that would have probably led to a really well-paying job at a local tech company. But no, Eric did not go that route. Instead, he got a very part-time job as an usher at Seattle's Paramount Theater. And when he was home in his parents' basement, he spent 40 to 60 hours a week for 4 years creating an imaginary world called Stardew Valley, a video game. It was kind of an odd choice.
It was risky in that while all of my peers were getting valuable experience in the field, I was making a video game for 4 years, which wouldn't necessarily translate to something that, you know, a real company is going to be interested in on a resume. In terms of my friends and my family and everything, I guess one of the risks of that was just if I had said over and over that I was going to be a success, this game was going to do well, you should trust me, you should have faith in me, and then it failed, I would be a joke. I had to prove it to everyone that I was serious, and their faith in me was, you know, well-placed.
You had to create a persona that sold this to your friends and family who maybe would have otherwise had questions about this decision, this choice that you made to pursue this game the way you did, 60 hours a week and a lot of time. Could you talk about that face that you had to put on?
So I had a lot of doubts. I had personal doubt about whether I was doing the right thing, whether I was going to be a success, whether I even had the talent or the drive or whatever to finish this project and for it to be a success. But I knew that having that doubt would only get in the way of me achieving it. So I basically had to force myself to stop thinking about that. And the way I did that was to take on this personality of just insane ambition and faith in myself. You know, they say fake it till you make it. That's basically what I did. I just started acting as if I had 100% faith. Like, this is going to be a success. It's going to be a great game. Everyone's going to love it. I'm going to finish it. There's no doubt in my mind. And like, just acting that way, it made me actually start to believe it after a while. And I started to actually become a lot more confident about it. And I think that helped convince the people around me that they should believe in me, because when someone's really passionate and excited about something, it's hard to not take them seriously.
And that, in doing that, it boosted your confidence, but it also heightened the risk.
That's right, yeah. Because then if I failed, it would be even more of a fall, you know?
And you don't have to put that on any longer.
Right.
What was it like to let go of that?
It feels good in some ways. I'm definitely a lot more relaxed now than I was before the game came out. But it's strange. I also feel almost like I lack purpose now. Like, making the game was just, it consumed my entire life. And now that it's done and I've already, you know, achieved the success that I wanted to achieve, it's like I've been forced to completely rethink what I'm going to do with my life. So I feel kind of lost in a way.
Do you think it's time to start going on some job interviews at Microsoft?
No, I don't think so. I want to keep making things. That's what gives me purpose in life, is to create experiences for other people. A lot of the experiences I had in video game worlds just feel very real to me. I think that that's true for many people, that game experiences can be special and they can feel poignant and real.
And we have to talk about the success of Stardew Valley. When did you know it was starting to take off?
I had a feeling of like a day or two before launch that it was going to be pretty big. You know, on the first day I saw that there was like 30,000 units sold or something, which other developers were telling me that's like insane, you know, and then it just kept going up. It kept just, sales were just going just astronomical for weeks and weeks. And, you know, when I hit 100,000 sales, I was thinking, this is amazing. But then, you know, after a few months, I hit 1 million sales, and now it's at 1.5 million sales, and it's still growing. So it's just, it's completely blown my mind. I don't even know how to, I haven't even fully grasped the success yet. It's just, it's mind-boggling.
How much money does 1.5 million sales, how much does it come out to?
So far, the game has grossed $20 million.
I'm going to repeat that again. Stardew Valley has grossed more than $20 million. And the one person who has seen this entire process unfold from start to finish is Eric's longtime girlfriend, Amber Hickman. They met when they were in high school working at a pretzel shop. Eric eventually moved out of his parents' house and into a home near Green Lake in Seattle with Amber and another couple. She helped support Eric over the last 4 years. She always believed in what he was doing. But $20 million? She's still trying to make sense of this enormous number.
It's so abstract, the fact that there's millions of people around the world playing this game. Like, I can say that and I can like kind of understand it, but like that makes it kind of hard to really grasp like the impact that it seems to be having on people.
How is the money going to change your lives?
I don't imagine it'll change much. It hasn't really at this point at all. We've always been very simple. Like, our families have asked, like, oh, so when are you getting a new car or, you know, a house, things like that. And we're just kind of practical. Like, our car works perfectly fine right now, and I don't imagine we'll get a new one until it actually breaks.
The main thing is just to not have stress. There's no real time crunch or outside pressure on me to do anything, so I feel completely free and liberated in a way.
Can I see the game?
Yeah. Sure.
Is this where you spend a lot of time working on it?
Yeah. We're in my, I guess it's our bedroom, but a corner of it is my little office, and I have my computer here on a makeshift standing desk system.
Your keyboard is on.
It's sitting on top of my speakers, and the monitor is on top of an old box, but it works.
So yeah, I guess if you could tell us about Stardew Valley, what is it about?
Stardew Valley is a farming RPG, which RPG stands for role-playing game, and essentially you take on the role of a character who's moving to the country from the city and trying to start a new life after inheriting your grandfather's farm. So you start to build this life for yourself in the country, you know, watch it grow and reach, like, meet your goals and stuff like that.
So what is he doing? Is he harvesting?
Right now I'm clearing the land to find a little place to start growing some crops.
How do you win?
There really isn't a way to win. It's very open-ended. So there's kind of some goals that the game kind of suggests for you. Like, there's a run-down community center in the town. You know, with a little bit of magic, you can get it back up and running, and it kind of brings the town together and breathes some fresh and new life into the community. That certainly is a goal you can strive for, but there's no point actually where, like, the credits roll and it says, you know, the end.
It can just go on and on.
It just goes
on
and on. Some people have been playing it for hundreds and hundreds of hours. I think people just like living in Stardew Valley.
It seems so idealistic and so such a kind place. I mean, rehabbing a community center, working the earth, growing your own food. Do you hope that people do this in the real world after playing your game?
Some people have told me that Stardew has inspired them to go out in the world and to do things that they never thought to do before or that they were afraid to do.
Like so, what?
Meeting people, going out, doing community work, volunteering, farming, just real things. You know, it is a video game, but somehow it inspires many people to go out and do real things in the real world, which I think is healthy and good for the planet. So I'm happy about that.
That's Eric Baroni, the creator of the indie hit video game Stardew Valley. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Today, we're sharing stories about people who are taking some pretty significant risks in order to reach a goal. And sometimes the risk of doing something might not be worth the reward. In fact, there might not be any reward. Only pain and suffering are guaranteed to follow. This can happen when we let our emotions take over and our thinking can get a little cloudy. Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad found himself in one of these situations. It happened inside a bar, in a small town, in the middle of Washington. Everything was going great for Kevin that day until a very famous young man entered the room.
I feel like I never, ever, ever get out of town. So when I do take some time off, I just want to relax. And the best way I know how to truly relax is to go camping. So this last Labor Day weekend, I went to this little tucked away bit of land in Salmon Lissac, Washington, a handful of miles away from Clee Ellum. It was beautiful and perfect, even with a little bit of rain. As the weekend came to a close, my friends and I decided that on our way out of town, we'd make one last stop for a cocktail before facing the reality of heading back to work. So to enter or exit Salmon Lissac, you have to drive through the town of Roslyn, which has a population of about 900 people. It's also home to the historic brick saloon, which has been continually operating since 1889. It even still has the original 23-foot running water spittoon along the length of the bar. The perfect spot for one last libation before heading out of town. On this particular day, the Brick Saloon was busier than I assumed it might normally be, but by pure luck, right as we walked in, three seats at the bar opened up by the entrance, and we saddled up. I took that as a wonderful sign that this would be the perfect ending to a relaxing weekend. I sat between my two friends, filthy from camping, but I didn't care. While they were thrilled to have cell phone service again, I sat there silent, in kind of a rested daze, at peace with my whiskey, as customers came and went from the saloon entrance behind me. This part of the Brick Saloon was for ages 21 and older only, and the youthful appearance of a patron entering the building must have caught the eye of the bartender. "Can I see your ID?" she asked. Since my back was turned to the entrance, I couldn't see the person whose age she wanted to verify, but I could tell that this person wasn't breaking stride. And then he responded, "Google me. Google me. Google me." He said, "Google me." But the bartender didn't say a word, just sort of stood there with a blank look on her face. I turned in my bar stool to see this guy from behind, still not breaking stride, walking towards the pool tables in the back. Gray sweatshirt, white jeans, white high tops, short blondish brown hair, and tattoos on his neck. I turned back towards the bartender, who still looked a bit in shock. And then she said it. "I think that's Justin Bieber." Justin Bieber. Now, I have to tell you that I have always felt there's an especially warm place that entitled cocky young pop stars go when they die. And while I can't say that I know anything about his music, I think there might be a song where he says baby a lot in it. Everything I've ever heard or read about him sounded awful. Justin Bieber, the guy who was given a baby monkey, and when he tried to take it into Germany with him and didn't have the proper paperwork, just left it there at the airport. Justin Bieber, the guy who allegedly shut down a major strip in Miami so he could drag race. Justin Bieber, the guy who kicked the Argentinian flag off the stage at one of his concerts in Argentina. Justin Bieber, the guy who urinated in a custodian's mop bucket. And many of you might remember his last trip to Seattle because he got a lot of press for it, for walking out on a $130 bar tab at a bar in Belltown. And on and on and on. And as it turned out, this was most certainly Justin Bieber in the flesh and blood. Patrons indeed Googled him, trying to see if the tattoos on his neck matched the ones in pictures of him online. They did. It was him. Now, has he ever done anything to me personally? No, but for him to stroll into a bar in the middle of nowhere on my last moments of vacation, well, I took that very personally. Was no place safe from arrogant, troublemaking pop stars? Why this place, in this small town, on the one weekend I get away? Why him? As he stood by the pool tables holding a pool stick behind his neck horizontally, with his arms sort of draped over on either end, this Jesus on the cross sort of posture, it became clear exactly what I needed to do. I was going to walk over to Justin Bieber and punch him right in the face. Now, I am not a violent man. I've never been in a fight, and I have never punched anyone in the face. I can't say that I've even really been tempted to. Not only that, but punching Justin Bieber in the face would have almost certainly landed me in jail, and I had to be on the air the next day, so it probably would have cost me my job, too. But I was overcome with an emotion that I have never felt before. It was as if I wasn't just going to punch Justin Bieber in the face for disrupting my last few moments of tranquility, but I'd be doing it for everyone out there that has seen or heard on TV some of the awful things that he has said or done and said to themselves, "Man, I'd really like to punch that guy in the face." And there are lots of people that want to punch Justin Bieber in the face. Google it. And here I was with that opportunity. I got up and I walked to the bathroom, deliberately walking right by him, just to see how high the adrenaline would get when I was that close. It was there. I could do this. After leaving the bathroom, I walked outside for some air, once again passing Bieber, who was now enjoying what appeared to be a taco salad. It was the moment of truth. My nerve was up. I just needed a sign to tell me either go do this or don't. And that sign came. As I stood outside, it hit me that the social media element to Bieber being here would probably kick in soon. And right as I completed that thought, I saw a girl who couldn't have been older than 14 bolting up the sidewalk and up to the door of the bar. While too young to enter the bar, She had her cell phone in hand, ready to take as many pictures as she could of the inside of the bar every time the door would open. Her eyes were wet. She was practically trembling. For better or for worse, Justin Bieber has brought joy to millions and millions of people. That song that I thought he sang where he said baby in it a lot, I looked it up and it's been viewed almost 1.5 billion times on YouTube. That's a little less than 5 views per person from every single person in the United States. So basically, me punching Justin Bieber in the face might make me the good guy to a few millions, but I would be the bad guy to a couple billion. And who, I ask of you out there, wants to be the bad guy to billions of people? I walked past the shrieking teen back inside the bar and took in the view of stardom for another couple moments. Young Bieber had clearly reached the limit on the amount of attention that he wanted to receive as he was turning down posing for pictures. That's one of his things now, by the way. No pictures with fans. Google it. Popped his hood over his head and passed me while heading for the door. There's this stigma that is often attached to misbehaved teenage rock stars, that they act this way because they never had real parenting or a real childhood, that they never got to develop normal social skills because they grew up on a tour bus and never had anybody real to talk to. I've never found that as a justifiable excuse for terrible behavior, but for a moment, as he walked out, he struck me as human. Before the door could shut behind him, the voice of a teenage female outside of the bar was heard yelling, "I love you, Justin!" "I love you too," he shouted back, before hopping in the back seat of a black SUV and disappearing into the Roslyn sunset. Justin Bieber fans refer to themselves as Beliebers. And I remain a staunch non-Belieber. But if your music can bring so much joy to one teenager that it convinces one grown man not to punch an almost grown man in the face, then maybe there is a reason to believe after all. I don't know. Google it.
That essay from sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. You're listening to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX, and we're talking about risks and rewards today. And as we just heard, sometimes the risk just isn't worth it. But for some professions, there is no backing down. Taking risks is a requirement of the job. This is the case with professional football. It's arguably the most dangerous sport to play and the most popular to watch. The National Football League has tweaked some rules to make things a little safer for players, but these athletes, they still get hurt quite badly. Seattle Seahawks wide receiver Ricardo Lockett suffered an injury that almost killed him. Lockett recently spoke to GeekWire reporter Taylor Soper at the annual GeekWire Summit as part of the Geeks Give Back campaign, and he talked about the reward of finally being able to make it onto CenturyLink Field as a professional player, and the devastating injury that led to his retirement.
So you made the team, but you didn't actually play your first game until about 4 months later, December. Home game, CenturyLink Field. I mean, you got to be like, it's electric, right?
For sure.
And the first play, Seahawks have the ball, Tavares Jackson drops back, 44 yards, you're right there, you make the catch. You're right on the Seahawks sideline. Everyone's going crazy. I mean, that's got to be like an amazing feeling.
That was actually one of the best days of my career because my dad, coincidentally, my dad's favorite team is the 49ers.
Perfect.
retract that. no, his team is the 49ers. But so my first play was Christmas Eve. We played the 49ers on Christmas Eve. And I told my dad, I said, "Hey, watch the game today. I got something to show you." So he's thinking, he doesn't know that I'm active. He just thinks, hey, he's going to be standing on the sideline with a sweatsuit. I hope he doesn't run across the field and do something crazy. But so the very first play of the game, Christmas Eve, my dad's favorite team, his son that he's coached his entire life is walking out on the field. And he's like, he said, I was watching it and I thought that was you. I wasn't quite sure. And next thing I knew, they hiked the ball and they threw you the ball. And I was just hoping that you caught it. I was hoping that you caught it. And when you caught it, I couldn't stop the tears from my eyes because you, that was everything I wanted you to experience. I wanted you to know that you are great and that anything is possible. So that Christmas Eve was one of the best Christmas Eve and the best gifts I probably could have gave my dad.
Yeah, it's an amazing moment. So let's jump to last November, almost a year ago now. Mm-hmm. You're in Dallas. You're sprinting down as fast as you can on the punt coverage, and bam, you know, you get hit, you fall, you're not moving. What was going on in your mind?
So on this play, we typically don't like the Cowboys, but so we're running down, and Coach Carroll, he's like, hey, let's go, Rocket, we need you, let's roll, and he's really high energy like that. So, but we're getting ready to roll, and the ball is snapped, and I give a move, and I'm running down the field, and I check to see the flight of the ball because I'm going right for the returner, no breaks. So I'm running right for him, and I see him, and I'm pushing this guy off. And then all of a sudden, I hear kind of the sound where you hear if you were hit a fork on the side of a glass. It's like just ding, and I'm just laying there. And the only thing I could move is my eyes. And I'm looking around. I can't hear anything. And that was a moment where a lot of things changed in my life. I look at myself as a warrior. I look at myself as someone that can't be stopped. I look at someone that has just an unbreakable personality. And at that moment, I was extremely vulnerable. I wasn't a warrior. There was nothing that I could do for myself. So I'm laying there, and I'm just asking God to just give me the opportunity to get up and walk again. Give me the opportunity to hug my mom again. Give me the opportunity to at least tell my daughter that I love her and I want her to be great in life. And at that point, I'm laying on the ground and touchdowns and X's and O's and Super Bowls don't matter anymore. And that's when you realize what's really important in life. And what's really important in life is affecting others in a positive way, how they feel about you. And if you leave today, what did you do to help mankind, your family, your brothers, your sisters? And that's what's important to me now. And, I had great doctors and a great training staff that helped me out. And I'm laying there, and pretty much my skull is disconnected from my spinal cord. And if my teammates were to come over and say, hey, get up, you know, and pull my hand or move my arm, I would have died. If the play would have extended a couple more seconds and the guy would have ran the ball and fell on top of me or whatever, I would have died. If the training staff had came over and just tried to pick me up or put me on the cart some kind of way, I probably would have died. But I think I'm thankful to be here. I'm thankful to God that I'm here because their training, their studying, their passion for what they want to do, what they wanted to do and be, saved my life. And I dare not take that for granted because there's a lot of people that are in the hospital right now that are fighting for their lives. There's a lot of people that's not here today, and I dare not waste another day not giving my all to be the best I can be and giving my all to help others complete their dreams and their goals in life.
Yeah, that's really good. That's awesome.
Yeah, it had definitely changed. So so maybe like an hour after the hit happened, it took my daughter and my family a little while to get to the hospital. And my mom and the doctor says, hey, your daughter's outside. My daughter, November 1st was actually her birthday. So she came to that game as a birthday gift from me. And so she's like, she's outside. She's 10 years old. And she's at the door, blah, blah, blah. And and they're like, do you want her to come in? So at this point, I have to think about, you know, I'm the hero, I'm the warrior in my daughter's life. She's my little girl, she's my angel. Do I want her to see me like this and you know, daddy's all bandaged up, stuff's all on his neck, wires and stuff everywhere. Do I want her to see me like this? Do I want to see her at my weakest point? So my answer was yes, because I wanted her to feel okay. I didn't want her to go to sleep not knowing what happened to daddy, or not knowing this or not knowing that. So I wanted to fill that void in her brain. Once she got in, all my tears went away, all my pain went away, because, like I say, my purpose was bigger than the effort or the work it took to get the job done. The job that I had to get done was to show my daughter that no matter what happens, you can always win. There's always another day. Hey, daddy's gonna be okay. You know, don't cry. It's okay. It's football. You know, it's not. We're gonna have a birthday party tomorrow. At this point, I don't know if my neck is broken. I don't know if I ever walk again. I have no idea. But all I know is that I have 2 to 3 minutes with my daughter that thinks I'm the greatest thing that ever happened to life. And I have to make her happy. And that was what I did. And I'm glad that I chose to let her come in the room.
Yeah, it's an amazing moment. And so you did decide to retire earlier this year. And as we talk about how your perspective has changed, you've also, I mean, it's tough to hang up the cleats, but you dedicated your life to helping others in need.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because others helped me when I was at the lowest point or at the worst point in my life. And coming out of hospital, I would say maybe like an hour after that, I saw a group of homeless people on the corner, and it had to be at least 100 of them. And I couldn't believe that this many homeless people were on the street, because, you know, in Georgia, you don't see that many. In Seattle, you see it here and there, but Dallas, it was more people on the street than is probably in here. And I was just wondering, what could I do? What could I do? What could I do? And I'm an hour out of surgery. Obviously, I can't do much. I can barely move. And I tell the driver to turn around, let's go by this burger place. And we bought 100 burgers. And ever since that day, trying to help homeless and just giving back has just been a snowball effect for me. And I'm excited about everything that I'm going to be doing and doing in the future.
Yeah, that's awesome. And speaking of helping others, you are helping out the Seattle Science Foundation with some pretty cool work they're doing with spinal injuries. Mm-hmm. You can talk a little bit about that.
Well, these guys are amazing. The Seattle Science Foundation is actually ran by Dr. Shane Tubbs and Dr. Rod Askewian. They're great. And what we're planning to do is we're trying to raise awareness for a spinal cord injury. We want to raise awareness. There's actually 17,000 spinal cord injuries that happen every year. And our plan is to do actually the first 3D mapping of the spinal cord so that we have a better understanding of how it works, the different intricates of the brain and how it works with the spinal cord, to one day make the wheelchair a thing of the past.
That was former Seattle Seahawk Ricardo Lockett talking to GeekWire reporter Taylor Soper recently at the annual GeekWire Summit. Welcome back to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and we're going to close out the show today with a band, Sebastian and the Deep Blue. Most bands, they work really hard to set themselves apart from other groups or artists by developing a specific sound, a style. Being easily defined, it can really help out with marketing. But this is not so with Sebastian and the Deep Blue. From one song to the next, this group can sound like a completely different band. The members, they're all okay with this. And they know that being eclectic is a risk, that it might make it a little more difficult to develop a fan base. Barry Sebastian, who leads up Sebastian and the Deep Blue, sat down with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad to talk about the reward of not being labeled and why, for him, creativity trumps all.
All right, so can you introduce your band for us?
In the band, we've got Kyle on drums, Martin on bass, Elena on violin, Emily on harmony vocals, and then in the horn section, we've got Amelia on baritone saxophone, Michael on tenor saxophone, Haley on trombone, and vocals.
So you're Barry Sebastian. So that explains the Sebastian part of the name of the band. Where does the Deep Blue part come from?
Okay, so the Deep Blue, I was pining over a name for a long time. It was Barry Sebastian plus band. And I was like, I didn't really like that, but I didn't know what to call us. And so I came up with sort of like imagery that I was using. And basically the way I saw it was Sebastian was kind of like my sort of young, uninhibited, sort of imaginative child self, like out in this forest type area. And then in the middle of all this wilderness was like a blue sort of square, almost like a pixel that had been removed. And so then you look down into that, and that was sort of the way I was imagining like the Deep Blue. It was like the imagination, because I wanted to keep imagination and creativity at the forefront of this, because it's really easy to be like, well, you know, maybe people aren't going to get this song in 11/8, you know, or whatever. So maybe we should like go more straight ahead. So I put that in the title to just like continually remind myself, like, what's the point, you know? And to not get swept up into like trying to win a popularity contest and change the music in order to do it.
I want to get back to that in a minute, but I want to read a few things for you real quick. So on your website, under the About section, it says, "The Deep Blue is a post-punk inspired chamber pop band with full brass and string section, a high energy horn-powered Afrobeat inspired alternative rock and roll band. Artful arrangements combined with pop sensibilities to create a sound which is undeniably their own. Think Talking Heads, Budos Band, and Sufjan Stevens all rolled into a burrito, a musical burrito." So, first of all, I think my head just exploded, right?
Yeah.
So that's a lot. That's almost sounds like everything ever in music.
Yeah.
So you talked about not wanting to be creative and not worry about popularity or anything like that. Is that a risk that musicians take sometimes to be, you know, when you have the ability to be so many things and not to be labeled or narrowed down to one genre or another? Is there a risk in that?
I think the biggest risk is just adequately trying to explain it, you know, like verbally, which I feel like words have kind of always been poor descriptors of music anyhow. But in this situation, I feel like that has definitely always been the hardest thing. I've been asked to do, like, what's your radio pitch or what's your elevator pitch? And I just, I don't really know. So that does become risky. But I think the reward is, like, well worth it, because, you know, I'd rather be prolific at making music than, like, come up with the one thing and work with it for 7 years or whatever till it, like, sticks with people. And that is a risk, like, because, you know, you got to make a living, you know, but at the same time, for me, creativity is paramount.
Well, through no small coincidence, you guys have a song called Risk Reward, which you're going to play here for us in a minute. But I was wondering if there's any meaning behind that song. What's the song about?
Lyrically, I try to write songs about emotions that last for, you know, you could feel bummed out for 2 hours, and it's like, oh man, I'm feeling a moment of insecurity. And so this isn't that moment of insecurity or the moment of confidence. It's like the in between where you're like, what do I do here? Am I gonna take that chance? Am I gonna, you know, walk through the door? Am I gonna be afraid? Am I going to be confident? What am I? It's like that in between. I find a lot of room for things to grow in that sort of like washy area where it's like, what's next, you know? So it's really about that tiny moment in between self-doubt and self-confidence.
Well, Barry Sebastian of Sebastian and the Deep Blue, your latest album is called Meritocracy. Thanks for coming in, and let's hear Risk Reward.
All right.
I'm leaving.
Nice job, guys. That felt pretty good.
That was Sebastian and the Deep Blue performing their song Risk Reward. Their latest album is called Meritocracy. You can catch them next at the Sunset Tavern on November 23rd, and there's also a video of their performance at our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. That does it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Contributions come from John Cook and Taylor Soper at GeekWire, Parker Miles Blohm, John Kessler, and Luke Brummer. Special thanks to Eric Baroni for his music. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. And if you have any feedback, or maybe there's a story you'd like to share, you can always send us an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week with Under the Influence.
It was like they gave me some kind of a medal that I can wear with pride. I know what I'm capable of because these people who are great at it tell me what I'm capable of. And so any doubt that comes from any other direction, it's sort of a shield against that.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.